This is the Autosport Podcast with Henry Hope Frost.
Hello everybody, the Autosport Podcast is back. Yes, like overtaking in F1, we've returned after far too long. So, what have we got in store for you, holed up here in Autosport Towers? We'll take an in-depth look at the F1 season to date, we'll debate the effectiveness of the new rules and the domination of Sebastian Vettel, and we'll ask why it takes McLaren and Ferrari half a season to challenge on a regular basis. And then, like Lewis Hamilton off the lights in Melbourne, we'll speed through the rest of the motorsport world, offering some expert analysis on everything from Sebastian Loeb's new Citroën deal to the success of GP3 as the feeder formula of choice. Joining me then, Henry Hope Frost, in the studio are Autosport's editor-in-chief, Andrew Vandenberg.
Hello.
Magazine editor, Charles Bradley.
Hello.
And news editor, Glenn Freeman.
Hello.
Coming up on the Autosport Podcast.
On the phone later on, we'll speak to our man in the F1 paddock, Mark Hughes, and if we can tear him away from the stages, our muddy rally correspondent, David Evans. And make sure you stick around to the end of the pod, as we'll be giving away a pair of tickets to the Autosport 6 Hours at Silverstone on September the 11th.
Formula One, the season so far.
Okay, so to start us off then, Formula One 2011. For years, critics have derided F1 for being too processional, lacking in overtaking and excitement. This season, though, we've got the drag reduction system adjustable wing, tyres that vary hugely in performance as they wear out, and the return of kinetic energy recovery system Boost. Guys, has it worked?
To be honest, I would say when we get contested braking zones, it's working. So it hasn't always worked this year. But the problem we've had for too long in Formula 1 is that cars can't get within 1 or 2 seconds of each other. So when the DRS is tuned correctly, we're negating that disadvantage and bringing it back and opening up the opportunity. Yeah. The problem is when we have races like Turkey and Canada, where it was just too easy and cars were breezing by each other on the straights.
Yeah, that's the biggest problem I've had with it, is there's no way of defending it. You saw with Turkey, time and time again, someone gets in the zone, they've got the wing open, and they're just breezing by. There's no skill in that. What we want to see is people having to fight for a place rather than just having been given a place.
Charles? That said, I mean, a lot of the racing at the Tilke-built tracks has been awful, hasn't it? And the advent of DRS Pirelli tyres has really made some of those races come alive. I mean, look at China, for example, the way that Lewis chased down Vettel at the end as well. I think it's just added an extra element to it, really.
Do you think some of the circuits are to blame? So by their design, they're not going to work.
I think it's a combination of the circuits and the cars. I mean, you can't uninvent a downforce out of the cars, which stops them running closely together to be able to overtake.
Yeah.
This is the Autosport Podcast.
Right, joining us now on the phone is Mark Hughes from Spa-Francorchamps in Belgium. Hello, Mark.
Hello, everyone.
So far, 2011 has been all about one man, Sebastian Vettel. He's been racking up those wins and points, a bit like Michael Schumacher in the good old days. Are we looking at someone who's now a true great?
Yeah, I think probably we are. The signs have been there for a good couple of years now. He's, along with Alonso and Hamilton, I think those three are, there's a gap then to the rest. And I think you'd find it very difficult to sort of unstitch between which of those three is the top guy, and they're all absolutely exceptional. Whether we'll see a prolonged period of dominance from any one of those three like we saw with Michael, I doubt very much. I think that the field is much more competitive now in terms of the teams and also the depth quality of the drivers.
Yeah, now Sebastian's won 6 of the first 11 races for Red Bull, but since the British Grand Prix in July, both Ferrari and McLaren, who are Red Bull's chief rivals, they've appeared to be much closer. Why is this, and why has it taken them so long to get on the pace?
I think both Ferrari and McLaren made a breakthrough around mid-season in terms of fully understanding how you run the car with the very Red Bull-like rake, where you see the Red Bull since second half of last year has run with the nose down and the rear visibly higher. And it's taken Ferrari and McLaren this long to A, understand that was a key part of the Red Bull's advantage, and B, to make it work. I think with the big breakthrough for Ferrari came at Silverstone, and for McLaren it came one race later at the Nürburgring.
Hi Mark, it's Andy here. With Ferrari and McLaren sort of putting their efforts into making the car better now, do they not risk getting into a sort of vicious circle where they're behind the eight ball and Red Bull at the beginning of next season, and they're always forever playing this catch-up game?
Well, they're certainly, in terms of the championship, playing catch-up now. It's a tricky balancing act, whether, you know, Red Bull, logically Red Bull can almost forget about developing this car any further, you'd have to say, other than just the sort of residual ticking away. It's a very, it's an unnatural thing for a team to do, though, to switch off so early, even when they've got such a big points lead. So, I don't know, I suspect Red Bull are at the point of diminishing returns with this concept. Ferrari and McLaren are still on the steeper part of the improvement curve. So, it really depends which of them switch to the 2012 emphasis rather than, you know, keeping the development going for this year.
Hi, Marcus, Charles here. I'm just wondering where Renault and Mercedes fit in with this. Obviously, they're well behind Red Bull, Ferrari, and McLaren at the moment. How do they catch up, or do they now look solely at 2012?
Yeah, I don't think there's any feasibility of them catching up at this stage. There's been no sign that they have the potential to run with those three teams all year, really. They've flattered a deceiving qualifying earlier in the year a little bit, perhaps, but they've not really put a convincing race pace together that suggests they can run at Red Bull, Ferrari, McLaren pace. So, yes, realistically, I think they're probably looking very much towards 2012 already.
Hi, Mark, it's Glenn here. One of the topics we're going to get onto in a little bit is Michael Schumacher. You were talking about the strength of the field at the front of the grid this year. Do you think that's played a part in Michael's comeback being a little bit underwhelming?
Yeah, certainly. He's facing a stronger field than he had in his heyday. You know, once Senna was gone, really, the only guy in his league was Mika Hakkinen for most of his career. Now you've got a lot more of that calibre than you had then. So definitely that's played a part in it, but I wouldn't say that's all of it. But it's certainly a contributing factor, yeah.
OK, Mark, just one quick final question about Spa this weekend. F1's had a month-long summer break and there's been no testing. What are you looking for in Belgium this weekend?
Yeah, I'm looking to see if Ferrari and McLaren can continue with the improvements we've seen since the middle of the year. In principle, it shouldn't be the Red Bull's strongest circuit. It could very well play into Ferrari's favour. It's a very long circuit. Circuits are long and fast, so the tendency of the Ferrari not to be able to get its tyres up to temperature straight away in qualifying, that shouldn't really be a problem this weekend. So I'm looking for very strong performance from them. I'm looking to see what difference McLaren's new, more aggressive rear wing will bring it. We've seen so far in the season that they have a very conservative wing for qualifying, which is quite efficient for the race. For Spa, they will be debiting the more aggressive DRS type wing, so I would be looking for a good performance from them in qualifying.
And all hopefully playing out on one of the world's best Grand Prix circuits.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just a fantastic. This and Suzuka are just two mind-blowing tracks that should be the core of the championship for all time.
Good stuff. Okay, Mark, we'll let you get busy over in Belgium. Thanks for talking to us, Mark Hughes. That's it for part one then. Coming up in part two, the strange case of Nick Heidfeld. And don't forget to stay tuned and you can win tickets to the Autosport 6 Hours at Silverstone on September the 11th.
Autosport News.
So, Glenn Freeman, custodian of the news, take us through what's happening at Renault. Nick Heidfeld is out, potentially, and in his place comes Bruno Senna.
Well, that's Renault's plan. As we speak on Wednesday afternoon, it's a bit of a legal situation between the two parties. What I will say is if Nick is in the car this weekend at Spa, as one of our F1 journos put it to me, that wasn't what Renault wanted for this weekend.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a shame. Nick's been a bit underwhelming in the car this year. I was at his audition test, you could call it, at Jerez earlier this year, and he did exactly what they wanted. He was straight on the pace, talking about development paths with the car, and it was minimal fuss. It was perfect. Unfortunately, he hasn't been able to quite find that last little bit of pace that you need in F1, especially in the fierce qualifying system that we have at the moment. So now Renault are looking at a few of their junior guys that they've got on their books, and they'd quite like to give Bruno a chance. Mm. And ideally, they want him in the car as soon as possible now.
You would say for them, they've got nothing to lose, really. I mean, Petrov has been pretty much at Heidfeld's pace for most of the season, which I don't think anyone was really expecting. You know, Heidfeld's got all this experience behind him, Petrov only in his second season. Looking at their junior records, you would think that Senna probably has got ultimately a little bit more potential than Petrov. So what's to lose? Nothing, I don't think.
No, I mean, Senna and Petrov raced in GP2 together with similar levels of experience. Vitali was slightly more experienced, actually. And Bruno finished second, and Vitali was seventh. But the biggest spanner in the works here is, of course, you can't break somebody's contract just because they've been a little bit under par. It needs to be a bit more clear-cut than that, and that's the case Nick's making at the moment.
Charles?
Bruno did the free practice at Hungary on the Friday morning. I thought he did a pretty good job, actually. It's quite tricky because you only get one set of tyres, and obviously you're learning the track and learning all about the car, and the tyres are only good at the start of the run. So the fact he set his quickest lap right at the end, obviously on very worn tyres, showed he had a lot more to come.
And another reason I think Renault want to get Bruno in the car now is that waiting in the wings about to win the GP2 championship is Romain Grosjean. He's almost certain to get a drive in the Renault F1 car at some point this year, and Renault can't really leave Bruno on the sidelines all season, and then when Romain finishes his championship, they put him straight in the car, and then Bruno would say, well, you've had me here all this time, why didn't you try me? So this way they want to try them both and give them both a fair crack of the whip.
Yeah, of course Grosjean raced 2 years ago alongside Alonso, which was a pretty tough thing to do. He's managed to sort of extricate himself from that scenario and build up his reputation again, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, his career was in tatters at the end of 2009, really. Renault was not a good place to be at the time. As you say, it was alongside Alonso. His average qualifying deficit to Fernando was half a second, which, looking back, he's quite happy with. Romain says now he's a completely changed man. He's done a lot growing up, which, if you've seen him over the years, you can tell he really is a changed man on the track and off it. And the way he's dominated GP2 this season, he's thoroughly deserving of the chance.
Now, this seat and this sort of driver conundrum at Renault has only come about because of the terrible injuries that befell Robert Kubica in that rally crash before the season. What's the latest on his recovery?
Robert's got one more operation to go, which is imminent, basically. And the key thing about this operation is that it will give him all the movement back in his elbow. And that's when they can really start to increase the speed of the recovery. And from there, the focus is on getting the physical strength back in that arm and making sure that all the tendons are right in his right hand, and he gets all his dexterity back, because that's going to be key to whether or not he can drive a Formula One car at pace again.
Andrew, it's going to be tricky, isn't it, for Robert? If he comes back and the car's not good enough, people will wonder whether it's him.
Absolutely, it's a difficult situation, one that sort of Massa finds himself in now after the horrendous injuries he picked up at Hungary the other year. It's like, is he a changed driver, or has he actually got back to the level that he was at before, and he was never quite as quick as Alonso is? So if he's got a teammate like Petrov, where we knew what the gap was between them in the first place, then maybe there's a bit more of an easy way of monitoring how well he's recovered. But if he's going up against Grosjean or an unknown quantity, then we'll never really know whether he's got back to the levels he was at before.
Charles?
With the nature of Massa's injury, though, obviously with it being a head injury, there was a question mark about whether he had the sort of resolve and that he'd lost anything mentally. Obviously with Robert, it's purely a physical thing of whether he can have that, as Glenn said, the dexterity to drive a Formula One car through Eau Rouge at ridiculous speeds. So as long as the doctors can do their job and he physically can recover, I don't see it being a problem.
There's a kind of mind over matter issue, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Must remember to get a psychologist for the next Autosport podcast.
This is the Autosport podcast.
At the Belgian Grand Prix, Michael Schumacher celebrates 20 years in Formula One. It's an amazing achievement, unlike anything he's done behind the wheel of a Mercedes in the past season and a half, of course. It's a most curious case, but Andrew, what's going on there, do you think?
Well, ever since he returned to Formula One, it's been a massive story. You know, when he was going to come back for Ferrari, but then he had the damaged neck and he wasn't able to do that, and then signing this 3-year contract at Mercedes with basically all the terms being on his side. But he's just not delivered, has he? He's only out-qualified Rosberg twice this year, and in the races he seems to show quite a good pace, but he can't help but drive into people. Vitali Petrov especially, they seem to have some magnetic attraction to each other. But not a weekend goes by without there being some sort of rumour, and there's one buzzing around just ahead of Spa that 20 years on from his debut, this may be the race where he announces his retirement. I think it's probably just the paddock Grapevine working overtime, but there's a sort of beautiful symmetry to it. If he did decide that the track where he's been unbelievably successful, I think he's won there 7 times if you include the one he was disqualified for, that silly plank, where that he was decide that that's the place to call it a day. But I'd be surprised actually if he does.
What do you reckon, Glenn?
I'd be surprised as well, because I think until Michael gets a chance to drive a really good top line car again, there'll always be that little bit of doubt in his mind about whether he has still got it, because it's so immeasurable at the moment. And one thing that I think the team believe as well is that Nico Rosberg is still a little bit of an unknown quantity, because we've never seen him A, up against a real top liner, or B, in a guaranteed race winning car. So while those doubts linger, I think in the back of Michael's mind he's always going to say, just one more season.
For me, I think he's holding his head high, because he hasn't fundamentally dumped or been dumped on by Rosberg.
Yeah, it's been very hard to judge. I mean, Michael's race pace in particular this year has been a lot stronger than the results suggest, I think, as well. Yeah, it's just one of those things that the longer it goes on, the longer he's probably more likely to continue, just out of sheer hope, really.
Yeah. So if he does go, who is likely to replace him? Paul de Resta, your old mate from DTM, he's made a good case for himself, hasn't he, at Force India?
He's done very well in his first half of a Formula One season. Paul's been sort of itching to get the chance for quite a few years now. I mean, it's a well-known story that he beat Sebastian Vettel in Formula 3 when they were teammates. But Paul went off to Mercedes to race in the DTM. He kept his tyres with the manufacturer. McLaren always kept a little eye on him as well because of their tie-ups. And for a little while now, it had been in the works that they were going to try and get Paul into Formula 1. He had the test driver role with Force India last year. Impressed them there, didn't make any mistakes, and got his deserved chance this year. He's shown well against an established teammate in Adrian Sutil. And the only real black mark on his copybook so far is that he's damaged a few too many front wings.
Charles, this week's magazine has dealt with Kimi Raikkonen's recent announcement that he wants to go racing again rather than rallying. Is he somebody who could perhaps figure on some Christmas lists for F1 teams?
I think Formula 1-wise, it's very tricky to see where he fits in with the whole equation. I think so many seats, certainly with the big teams, are already decided. I don't think he wants to drive for anything other than a top team, so I just don't see a natural fit. Where I do see is something like, obviously he's testing this week in the Peugeot Le Mans car. I could see him going down that avenue. I'd like to see him do some more NASCAR road races. Certainly he's done a couple of ovals out there in trucks and nationwide. I'd like to see him do the Cup road races. And why not try something like IndyCar? You know, there's the $5 million race coming up at Las Vegas at the end of the year. I'd love to see him try something like that.
Glenn?
One of the big questions that lingers over Kimi more than ever at the moment is his dedication. He went over to America earlier this year, and we understand that there were some big money offers there for him to go full time, to which he responded, I wouldn't really want to do more than 20 odd races. And that's not really how it works in motorsport. You don't pick and choose your schedules. In rallying, his Citroën and his co-driver have wanted him to go away and just spend some time really working on mastering pace notes. And they've said, look, if we do a week of intensive work on that, we reckon we can get you up another level. And Kimi said, he did it at the start, and he said, no, let's not do it again, there's no point. So you have to say, with that in mind, that he doesn't want to do that much. The sports car thing would be perfect. Peugeot don't have to give him a full season of racing. He can do Le Mans, he can do a couple of the other Grandi races, and he can spend the rest of his time doing whatever he wants.
Go online to autosport.com for even more motorsport news.
Right, joining us now on the phone is Autosport rally guru David Evans. David, you were feasting on sausage and Weissbier in Germany last weekend, where Sebastian Ogier inflicted Sebastian Loeb's first ever defeat on Rally Deutschland. But the real news, I guess, was that the world champions re-signed for Citroën for another 2 years. Wasn't he supposed to be going off to Volkswagen?
Well, that was a theory, yeah, it was indeed. But it hasn't transpired that way. And I think there's one big reason for that. I suspect that, or I know actually, that Jean-Marc Galès, the member of the management board of PSA Peugeot Citroën, spoke to Loeb twice over the summer, and it was, I think, the negotiations between such a senior member of the PSA board and Loeb that changed his mind. And as well, I think the result from Loeb in Finland had a big impact as well. You know, Loeb doesn't like the Thousand Lakes, and he went there and he won it. And he won it by driving within himself. Which is a really big thing for Sebastian. He doesn't like risking everything and going outside of his sort of security zone. And the DS3 clearly works on a really fast rally. And that, I think, convinced him that, you know, his future had to be at Citroën. You know, on top of that, the guy has been there for 10 years. He's won 7 championships, 66 rounds of the World Championship. You know, he is Citroën. As Gallet says, you know, Citroën and Loeb are Paris and the Eiffel Tower, and you really could not imagine the guy driving anything other than a Citroën.
Yeah, and despite winning in Germany, Ogier's not very happy with the situation that's unfolded there, is he? What's next for him now?
I don't know. It's an extremely difficult situation for Citroën right now. It kind of started early in the summer in Acropolis, where Loeb accused Citroën of favouring Ogier. And at one point, Loeb actually said, you know, now we know who's number one in this team, and it's Sebastian Ogier. You know, I mean, this was a fairly explosive interview that he did almost live, I think, on French TV. So the seeds were set there, and it's just deteriorated. And last weekend in Germany, it was appalling. The atmosphere in the team and the relationship between the two. Ogier himself has questioned his own future at Citroën. I spoke to Malcolm Wilson. He's prepared to talk to Ogier about next year. Ogier has a contract with Citroën for next year, but, you know, as he himself said, what's a contract worth?
Yeah.
The problem here is that Ogier, in his contract for this year, was told he would be able to fight with no team orders until it was mathematically impossible for him or Loeb to win the championship. Clearly, you know, what happened on Friday night last week in Germany kind of put that in the bin, essentially. And team orders were imposed. But the frustration for me here is that throughout day one, Ogier would have had an idea that this was coming. He had his chance to beat Loeb. Mm. And Sebastian Loeb finished day one 7 and a bit seconds up on him. So, you know, Ogier's quick to moan and gripe about everything, but he had his chance. You know, he could have beaten Loeb over day one, and the team orders perhaps would have favoured him. So, as I say, I think, you know, he will talk to Wilson about a move to Ford. But the obvious one, I guess, is VW in 2013, and I would expect that he'll be now at the top of VW's shopping list.
Yeah. Do you reckon now he's got this new deal, Sebastian Loeb has got more clout when it comes to saying who he wants to drive the number two DS3?
If Ogier goes, I would say undoubtedly Loeb is now in a stronger position than he's been for a couple of years. With Jean-Marc Gallas on side. I mean, don't forget that, you know, early days for Loeb at Citroën, he had Guy Frecolan, who was an extremely strong ally for him. And, you know, he as soon as Loeb started beating Carlos Sainz and Colin McRae in 2003, and then Sainz on his own in 04, and then Francois Duval in 05, there was nobody to touch Loeb at Citroën. And he built this incredible power base, and Danny Sordo came in and was always the number two driver. And that power base was definitely taken away when Olivier Canal replaced Guy Frecolan. And there's a feeling in the team that Sebastian Ogier is Canal's boy. And, you know, Canal has seen what Frecolan did with Loeb, and he wants to try and outdo Frecolan with the new driver. It's, you know, I can't see it working. I can't see, really, if Ogier goes, I can't see how Canal can stay. Because, you know, him and Loeb don't get on very well, and I'm sure that Frecolan is still having some sort of influence at the top of the PSA tree. You know, he's got a lot of old friends in the company. And, you know, we ran in Autosport some of the comments that Frecolan made about Canal, and PSA won't be reading this sort of stuff lightly.
David, it's Glenn here. I saw a bit of the footage from Germany last weekend. Obviously a fantastic result for Mini, getting a podium with Danny Sordo. But the thing that struck me the most was the onboard footage of the car. The chassis looked fantastic. Should we be reading too much into that result, though?
I think it's possible to see a podium from Mini and easily read too much into it. You know, we shouldn't forget it was Germany. Sordo's finished second there for the last three editions of the rally. And he has, you know, he's an exceptional way of reading that rally, because the grip level is constantly changing on the event, and, you know, car setup is absolutely vital for that rally. And Sordo sets the car up, you know, possibly better than anybody. So there's that to take into consideration. But you're absolutely right. It is a fantastic chassis, and that's the one thing from the first time that everybody has driven that car. They've all commented on the strength of the chassis. There was a question mark over the way the suspension was working, but again, you know, that's proved to be absolutely superb. The only issue they have is with the engine, really. The engine is short on grunt at the moment. And it's a difficult setup, the way that it's not a pure manufacturer deal. It's this kind of odd triangular thing where BMW is providing the engine work, Mini does the marketing, and ProDrive builds and runs the cars. Quite how that's going to pan out and, you know, how it'll work when they start a full campaign next year, we'll have to wait and see. But certainly there's not the sort of millions that someone like Volkswagen would have to chuck at the engine to get it right. I suspect they'll be doing, ProDrive will be doing some engine work themselves before the end of the year. But, you know, I would think they'll always be slightly behind Citroën for the rest of this year, certainly.
Okay, finally, mate, after a few years in the doldrums, the WRC seems to be in the ascendancy. Mini's arrived, Volkswagen's coming next. What can you tell us about Saab? Is that going to come to fruition?
Ooh, I don't know. From what I'm told, the negotiations with WRC are still going on. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure we've all seen the news recently that, you know, maybe Saab employees aren't going to get paid again in August. It's a very difficult situation. Personally, I would be surprised, astonished to see Saab arriving in the WRC. But that, you know, it would be fantastic news if they did, particularly with, you know, such another sort of legendary brand with Mini there already. But, you know, if Saab don't come, as you say, we've got VW, we've got Mini now, and there's talk of Subaru coming back, there's talk of Renault, Mitsubishi, you know, lots of manufacturers are talking about a WRC, and we have been through some very tough times, and we are definitely coming back now. You know, we've got a 10-year deal for the promoter, the promoter's recently been taken over, so it's certainly coming back to life now.
Okay, good stuff. Thanks for talking to us, mate, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you, David Evans. Right, we've taken the final corner and the flag's almost in sight, but before we sign off, a whistle-stop tour of the rest of the motorsport world. Glenn, you've been covering GP3 this season. There's been an astonishing 10 different winners in the category's second year. Sounds good, but what's the racing actually been like?
Well, Henry, the quality of the racing itself, not great unless the clouds decide to descend on the circuit. But the key thing about GP3 this year is the quality of the field. It had its first season last year and, you know, it attracted 30 plus drivers, as it has to, but we weren't really sure. None of the big names from that level really went over. But this year, its place on the F1 support bill has attracted drivers because they know the big teams are watching, or they hope the big teams are watching. But it's attracted the sponsors as well because they know they're getting exposure on Grand Prix weekends. So this year, the strength and depth in the field is brilliant. It's fantastic. Lots of good drivers. And for me, it reminds me of when I was covering the F3 Euro Series in its heyday. And we had all the best drivers at that level. We're all racing in one place. So a lot of the drivers we have now at the front in Formula 1, you could pick them out as stars of the future at the time because they were beating all the other top guys at that level. And it's quite good having Andy and Charles here because they were my two predecessors covering that championship, so they've seen it themselves.
Andy?
Yeah, no, I was very blessed, really. The first year I did it, we had Lewis Hamilton, Robert Kubica, Nico Rosberg, not to mention a host of other quality guys that have gone on to do other things like Nicolas Lapierre, Alex Prémat, Loic Duval. You know, as Glenn was saying, when you've got that many good young drivers in one place, you can actually see where the talent is, and it was clear. Oh, I forgot to mention Jamie Green, of course, who won the championship. I mean, it was such an embarrassment of riches that year, but you can really see where the talent's coming from, and it was clear to see that people like Rosberg and Hamilton were going all the way. I just wish that Jamie had made it to F1.
Charles?
I had Sebastian Vettel, Paul de Resta, Guido van der Garde, Kimi Kobayashi all in the same team, so it was even easier to draw parallels between their talents.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course we've got McLaren Autosport BRDC award winners Lewis Williamson, Dean Smith, Alex Sims flying the flag for Britain right at the front as well, haven't we?
Yeah, all doing a really good job, which, you know, makes us look quite good, fortunately. Yeah. But no, they're just part of a really good cast at the front of the field this year. But Alexander is very experienced at that level, and when the car's underneath him, he really is delivering, and he'll certainly be in the championship fight for the rest of this year. Lewis, considering his level of experience, has done a phenomenal job, and you think if he sticks around for a second year, he could be really the man to beat next year.
Proving conclusively that gearbox karting is good for you.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Charles, let's leap across the Atlantic. Dario Franchitti's been dominant in IndyCar again. He's on for, would it be title number four?
Yes, I think
amazing. Yep. But he's upset a couple of people along the way, hasn't he?
Yeah, you're quite right to say he's well ahead, and he's certainly got into his title nemesis Will Power's head. They had a little bit of a coming together at Toronto where Dario came off far better, and Will had a few things to say after the race. Since then, it looked like Dario was sailing to the title, but he had a real fumble at Loudon last time out, bit of a spin with Takuma Sato, and Power's closed back in again. But again, we had this crazy situation where they went green at the end of the race, and Power was in the pit wall, and again he went absolutely ballistic afterwards, giving the double bird to the stewards in a fantastic fashion. So he's become the real sort of character of the series. So,
a good value on Twitter as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's just made everything in IndyCar just looking so bright at the moment. You've got some fantastic jewels out there. You've got new car coming along. You've had a fantastic Indy 500 where, you know, the guy crashed the last corner, J.R. Hildebrand and Dan Weldon won, and things are looking bright over there.
The way the racing's been these last couple of races, thanks Henry, is it's almost an advert for not bringing a new car in. There've been the double foul restarts for all the controversy they've caused, especially on the ovals, have created some fantastic racing. We've seen people like Thomas Schechter being able to make up a dozen places around the outside at the front of the races. But what I really fail to understand is why some of these professional, experienced guys, when it comes to a road course, can't do a lap side by side with someone without feeling the need to drive into the car. It's so frustrating watching them. As soon as you come to a restart, you're just waiting for the time when someone in the midfield decides they're going to break 50 metres later and T-bone someone else. It's terrible.
Mm. Yeah, that's the biggest problem. It's such a great opportunity to have all these side-by-side restarts to create the great racing that we have seen at times this year. But the drivers don't want to seem to use any give and take. They just see it all as an opportunity to drive absolutely at the limit. And they don't seem to treat it as they treat a race start, which is your side-by-side, it's the first lap, don't try and win it all straight away. And I just get the impression that if we had double-file safety car restarts in F1, the level of driver we have there through the field, I mean, there's good guys at the front in IndyCar, we'd see much, well, more sensible restarts than we're seeing in IndyCar. They just need to calm down a little bit and stop blaming the officials.
It's not sort of IndyCar-specific tracks to blame, or the style of, or the type of car they're driving, is it?
I don't think so. I think it's their mentality. The longer the race goes on, the more desperate they start to get, and they just see it as too big an opportunity. I just think they need to calm down and all work together.
Mm. Something else that staggered me this year is that you've got one of the biggest teams over there is Penske. We all expect them to be right at the top of the tree, and yet their three drivers, only Power's actually won a race, and Andretti Autosport has got three of its four drivers into victory lane this year before Penske, with their three drivers, Castro, Neves and Briscoe, haven't even looked remotely like winning a race.
No, and if KV could get to the end of the race without one of their or all of their drivers in the wall, they would have won at least one, certainly with Taku in Brazil.
So the last four or five rounds or so, it's going to be good, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a great mix of road courses and ovals to come, all ending up with that Las Vegas, hopefully big money race if anyone shows up. So, yeah, loads to look forward to.
OK, thanks, Charles.
This is the Autosport Podcast.
So there we are then. Like a Team Lotus qualifying session, we've finished too soon. But before we go, it's competition time. As I promised earlier, you can win a pair of tickets to the Autosport 6 Hours at Silverstone on September the 11th. Simply email us the names of the winning drivers from this year's Le Mans 24 Hours. And the address you need is, pen and paper at the ready, autosport.competitions@haymarket.com. That's autosport.competitions@haymarket.com. Closing date is September the 1st, so good luck. Thanks then to the panel, to Charles Bradley, Glenn Freeman, Andrew Vandenberg, and to Mark Hughes and David Evans, of course, for their views, and to you, the listener, for tuning in. And that's a lap.
The Autosport Podcast is a wantsomemedia.com production.